You know, as we have looked at various Gospels, we've looked at Matthew, we've looked at Luke, we've looked at John. Somehow we just didn't do Mark. Do want to spend... Do what? Well, he is, but at the same time, not only is he repetitive, but he was actually most likely the first of the Gospel writers, though... Well, tradition says yes. Okay. There are a couple of... Was over John Mark. Yes. Yeah. But, you know, when we start looking at the Gospels, first of all, we find that German theologian Martin Kaler calls them passion narratives with extended introductions, and Mark definitely fits that. The passion is the focal point. That is that last week of Jesus' life, including the crucifixion and resurrection. And everything leads up to it. Everything points toward it. And especially in Mark, it's more of a, Mark's the shortest of the Gospels. It's a headlong rush toward that event. That's the pivotal event, in Mark. It's also the pivotal event for the other Gospel writers, but especially Mark. In Matthew, Luke, and John, anything that happens after those resurrection appearances and the teachings after that always look back to the crucifixion and resurrection. And so that's the focal point. And that's why Kaler said that the Gospels are passion narratives with extended introductions because of that. We've talked before about the importance of that crucifixion and resurrection as well. Now, Mark... though Augustine said that Matthew came first, though a couple of the early church fathers said that Matthew was first and Mark was an abridger, Mark, according to them, if they were alive in the 20th century, they would have said Mark was the Reader's Digest condensed version. There is much more evidence that Mark is actually the originator and Matthew and Luke follow Mark kind of as a template. Wherever Matthew and Luke agree with each other in their Gospels, they agree with Mark. Where they don't agree with each other, that material is not found in Mark. Though there are some scholars that try to put everything early, Matthew and Luke, as we've said before, probably 75 to 85. Mark is somewhere around 65 to 75, most likely between 65 and 70, 71 A.D., so he's the first one of those. Mark is written as narrative. It's not an epistle, which is a letter. It's not a homily or a sermon, which actually is the letter of James. James is a sermon in letter form. It's not poetry, but it's a narrative with an implied hearer or reader with definitive characters and structure of a narrative, trying to tell this story that is important. There are all kinds of ideas about these other things. Papias, one of the early church fathers, gives the first reference that we have to the Gospel of Mark as an official gospel or document. Papias lived between 120 and 140 A.D. He wrote to defend the authority of Mark because by the end of the first century, Matthew actually was the most popular of the Gospels. Matthew refers to the church as the New Israel. Matthew was seen as something of a church manual. And so Matthew was actually the most popular of those four Gospels by the end of the first century. And there are two reasons Matthew's listed first rather than Mark, Luke, or John. One of those is because it is so popular. Everybody used it, so when the church put together the canon, the New Testament canon, they put the one that was the most popular and most widely used. The other reason is because of Matthew's usage of the prophets, especially in the birth narratives and other things, the prophets. The church said, well, since Matthew uses the prophets so much, Matthew's kind of a bridge from the prophets. Remember, the Old Testament ends with the prophets. Kind of a bridge from the prophets into the New Testament. But Papias, that early church father, defended Mark as the authoritative Gospel, the first of those Gospels. He also claims Mark was Peter's interpreter. He says that he was John Mark. In fact, Papias went on to say that the John Mark who writes it was probably way over in the Garden of Gethsemane where Jesus is arrested. There's a really strange verse in there that says it was a young man who had followed with only a sheet, and they went to grab him too, but he ran out of the sheet and ran away naked. The only one of the Gospels refers to that, and it's just that one little blurb. Papias said that that was actually John Mark. Now, we don't know if it was or not, but... I don't know. And I don't know if there's somebody Ethel that he ran by either. Don't look, Ethel! Too late. But, you know, because it was typically, you didn't wear a nightshirt back then when you slept. You know, when Ruth uncovers Boaz's feet, you know, the word is not really feet. It means his nakedness. He was under the sheet with no clothes on. He slept in his birthday suit. What folks think is that whoever this was, whether it was John Mark or somebody else, said that a young man followed along and witnessed what took place. Well, if it was John Mark, and according to tradition, the house in which John Mark lived is the house in which the Last Supper took place. And so if that's the case, then, you know, he saw them leave. Well, he's lying there in bed already, on his mat already. And so all he does is wraps his top sheet around him and follows him. And then the soldiers try to grab him and arrest him too, thinking he's one of the guys, and he just drops the sheet and takes off.
Sort of like the old Ripaway jersey.
Yes. It's a tearaway jersey. But interestingly enough, Papias also said that Peter did not dictate this to Mark.
P-A-P-I-A-S.
P-A-P-I-A-S. That Mark followed Peter around and heard all of what Peter said, but then Mark, and Papias says, Mark wrote down everything that he remembered that Peter said. Because presumably by the time Mark writes, Peter is dead. He's been put to death in Nero's Rome. Oh, the Romans put a lot of folks to death. And they put Peter to death and Paul to death. And
grave woman. No, man. Sorry. Kids, woman. Romans. Ear. Cut.
Been the one in Jesus' heel.
No.
Not... Lazarus?
No.
Okay.
Romans. Man. Grace one. Kids one. Luke.
You killing the firstborn child? Is that what you're talking about?
No. Jesus locked up.
Jesus locked up.
Remember
the miracle when he healed it and put it back on?
Yes.
Grave.
Kids, one.
Yeah, I'm...
Is the daughter of the centurion that he raised from the dead healed or made well? Or?
No. Romans walked up. Jesus. Scared.
Oh, you got Pontius Pilate. You got who had him scourged. You've got Herod Antipas who had him beaten as well. But no, I'm not.
One. Was this in the Passion Week, or was this when was it? It
when
was
yeah. Yeah, well, the only thing about the swords in somebody's ear, that was a slave.
Yes.
That was a slave of the high priest, and Jesus healed it. It wasn't a boy. He was a slave.
No. Ham. Boom. Rhythm. Kiss. reading.
Is it in Mark? Is it in Mark?
Yeah, find out.
I mean, and you've got, I mean, the only thing you've got to get, you know, you've got the demoniac and those kinds of things. You've got the slave of the high priest that died, and Jesus simply spoke and he came to life. But the I am sayings, if it's connected to I am such and such, those are in the Gospel of John, not in the Gospel of Mark. If it's the I am sayings, they're in the Gospel of John. St. Augustine or St. Augustine said that, as I said, Mark was an abridger of Matthew, but that's probably not, I mean, that's not the case. In the late 1700s, we find a scholar by the name of J.B. Kopp saying that Mark is a chronicler who used Matthew and Luke, who was used by Matthew and Luke. And that's pretty much been the way, if you study them, he chronicles the life of Jesus, though not everything in it. And he produces from what he remembers of Peter's preaching and teaching about the life of Jesus. But he is definitely used by Matthew and Luke. In fact, between 70 and 77% of the Gospel of Mark is found in Matthew and Luke, and much of that verbatim.
Well, is Matthew an original disciple?
Tradition says he was. Well, Mark's gospel was in circulation at least 10 years prior to, if not 15 years prior to, when Matthew and Luke write.
Did not put it down on paper? Well,
don't know for sure, but Matthew definitely quotes a lot, almost verbatim, from Mark. Luke does as well, and then they both have sections that are only in them. Some of the parables are, but also some of the parables, you'll have a parable in Mark, and then in Matthew and Luke, it'll be the same basic parable, but there'll be slight changes in either the character. Like in Mark, you'll have a rich young man. In Luke, he's a rich young ruler. By the time you get to Matthew, he's a wealthy king or ruler, because it impressed more and more on their particular readers. But between 70 and 77% of Mark is found almost verbatim in Matthew and Luke. In fact, even some of the more left-wing leading theologians of the 19th and 20th centuries, one of them, Rudolf Bultmann, who basically sought at one point to demythologize the Gospels, anything that was miracle outside the norm, he said, well, that was simply myth that the church put in there. But even Bultmann will come along and say that Mark is the originator of the whole gospel genre. He writes the first one. There's nothing that predates him that is like what he writes. So what Mark writes gives us this, even though the epistles of Paul precede it, what Mark writes gives us this snapshot, if you would, or series of snapshots of the life of Jesus. They're called pericopes. They're little short parables or short situations in which the gospel is presented kind of in microcosm. Mark is probably written, as I said, between 65 and 70 or thereabouts. You got the fall of Jerusalem in 70 to 71, the destruction of the temple. He is probably writing prior to that. In fact, he's probably writing prior after the death of Peter, but prior to some of the even worse things that Nero did, because he doesn't really refer to Nero as this anti-God, bestial kind of character. There's some people who try and place it in the mid-70s because Titus came in and began erecting standards, Roman standards, in the temple. And Mark chapter 13 refers to an abomination of the temple. But I don't see that, and most scholars don't either. But Mark and Revelation, the writer of Revelation, do have something in common. Both of them are writing to a persecuted church, a persecuted group of believers who are facing death, who are facing tortures, and for whom the message is one of hope in the face of persecution. The Gospel of Mark is filled with opposition to Jesus. In the first half of the gospel, the opposition is from religious leaders. In the second, and some Romans, but in the second half of the gospel, it's not just religious leaders, it's some of his own followers that begin to oppose what he's teaching and what he's trying to do. And so there's this sense that the Christians who are being persecuted then see how Jesus was persecuted, and they're called to be followers, and Jesus is going to vindicate them if they follow him closely, even unto death. And so by showing this persecution of Jesus, and yet he went all the way through, he suffered, he bled, he died, he was resurrected. So in the face of persecution, you are to willingly face suffering, if possible, death, and you'll be vindicated by Jesus. And so that's a message of hope in desperate times. Well, that's the whole point of any apocalypse, and that's the whole point of the book of Revelation. Not to tell you how the world's going to end or when the world's going to end, but to tell you that in the midst of this persecution, if you live like this, you're going to be vindicated by God. And interestingly enough, the two, at the times that these are written, the two Roman emperors are Nero, at the time Mark is writing, and Domitian, at the end of the first century, who many Christians thought was, there was this belief that the beast would be the reincarnation of Nero or someone just like Nero. Well, Domitian persecuted Christians and Jews just as badly as Nero did the Christians earlier in time. Domitian was the sixth Roman emperor to have claimed for him that he was divine. And he himself claimed he was divine. Nero claimed he was divine. And so you've got this whole message of hope for desperate people in desperate times that are facing persecution and death at any moment, any day. And so that's also part of why Mark is so fast-paced. And you don't have, in Matthew, there are more miracles recorded, and Matthew takes more time to delineate the story as opposed to Mark, who's writing in this time. You know, Matthew's, yes, there's persecution, but it's not quite as terrifying and rapid as Nero. You know, we've said it before. We do know that that Nero used the burning of Rome to help, I call it his urban renewal project. He wanted to be known as a great builder as well. And so some of his, according to Suetonius, Roman historian, some of Nero's own captains were seen setting the fires that burned down Rome. And then Nero comes back and he builds it in all its grandeur and splendor, and everybody thinks how wonderful he is. Well, he had to blame somebody, because people started saying, wait a minute, this isn't right. The city burned. Who did it? Who did it? They need to pay. And so he blamed the Christians. As we've said before, Christians were, they met at night, so they were subversive. You know, anybody that meets at night, subversive. That's what they thought. They were atheists because they wouldn't worship the emperor. And emperor worship was in vogue. And they were cannibals because they ate flesh and drank blood. In particular, they ate the flesh and drank the blood of one Crestus. Obviously a misunderstanding of the Lord's Supper or communion. But that, so they were held with great suspicion. So Nero said, well, these folks did it.
When in that time, what were the zealots?
Yes. Yes, the zealots were.
I mean, so the Christians could have been persecuted for something they did do if you were a zealot,
Zealot, yes. And Jesus had at least one, Simon Zealotes, Simon the Zealot, in his band.
Because they murdered people.
They murdered Roman soldiers. The zealots took a vow. The Sicarii of the zealots, the dagger men, so known for the short dagger they carried, took an oath that if they had an opportunity to stab a Roman soldier and kill him and get away, they were bound by oath to do it.
It was a holy war.
It was a holy war, and God, they used religion for their political ends. And so, you know, they were blamed for some of that, but more so these other things, as well. Tacitus writes in his annals.
I have a question.
Yes. There were different sects. The town Essenes were more peaceful than the Essenes who lived at Qumran. We have come to discover through archaeology and some of the other things, and the war scroll, they were preparing for this great cataclysmic war. They weren't the nice, meek little monks that people often think. They were actually preparing for a holy war. They They practiced with weaponry, various ways to fight and to kill and all of this, and they based it on their interpretations of Scripture. And they were ready not only to fight against the Romans, but they didn't like the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They had disagreed over how worship should take place, and the Pharisees and Sadducees actually won out and banished them from the temple. And so they went out, and in if you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, there are a lot of Pesharim, which are commentaries that they make on the Scriptures, and they'll take things out of the prophets, bits and pieces, and then they'll write, and these are the ones who, and it's pointing directly to the leaders of the temple in Jerusalem.
So is it purposeful, in your estimation, that Jesus picked as his 12 disciples such different philosophical men to follow him?
Oh yes, I think Jesus chose from those who showed an inclination or showed an interest, or that would help, this wide range would help to understand that he didn't just come for the narrow-minded Jew. He came for all kinds of folks, from the tax collector who was hated to Judas, who ends up betraying him but may have been a zealot because he was from Kerioth, which was a hotbed for zealots, to Simon the zealot, to the good old boy fisherman, and all points in between. So I do think it was very purposeful that he chose this wide range of folks.
We don't get that usually when we talk about disciples. No.
No.
They all followed Jesus, but they were not like-minded.
No, they were not.
The way they felt the kingdom should come.
No, they were not. If Judas was a zealot, and personally that Nadal gets to drink the drink machine, I think he was. If Judas was a zealot, he never intended for Jesus to die. He intended to put Jesus in a position where Jesus would prove to be the zealot's Messiah, and all these people would rally around him, and he'd kick the Romans out, and they'd get to rule. Matthew saw it from a different perspective. It backfired, and he couldn't live with it. And he realized, wait a minute. And he says, wait a minute, I betrayed innocent blood. I can't live my... And they said, well, you see to it. You did it. Go live with it. And instead of going out, taking his 30 pieces of silver and going out to the bar or something, he throws it down and he goes out and kills himself because he can't live with it. I really sometimes wonder if Judas may not have been the first of those 12 that suddenly realized there was more to Jesus' messiahship than any of them knew. And he couldn't live with it. And so he went. It backfired, and he was so disillusioned with himself. I really think that he thought, you know, Jesus is about to wimp out. And he's talking about dying instead of, and his kingdom being not of this world, but being of the other world. And he's going to die and all this kind of stuff. And Judas says, wait a minute, I followed you for 3 years. And now you're going to do this. Well, by golly, I'll put you where you have to defend yourself. And everybody will follow you then because you'll be Messiah. Well, it's a different kind of Messiah. Because remember the whole idea of Messiah from way, way back. Saul was the first one called Messiah. He was the Lord's anointed, the king. David was the second one called Messiah. So they tied that so much to an earthly political ruler that they couldn't see the forest for the trees.
Makes you a little less
condemning. Yeah. We tend to do it.
And think, well, you know, he was just wrong, bad, evil traitor. But if you look at it from what you just said, he was not a traitor. He was believing
a different kind of Messiah, and he was trying to fit Jesus into the mold that he expected. None of us ever try to fit Jesus in the mold we expect, though, do we? But he was trying to do that. And so, you know, Mark is produced during this time. Tacitus, Roman historian in his annals, talks about, we've mentioned before, Christians being taken to the Colosseum and covered with wild animal skins. They turn loose packs of dogs to go in there to tear them apart. Or they're taken in and put across from the best gladiators, and they're given a whip, and the gladiator's got his spear and his sword and his trident and all that kind of stuff. Or Nero had them tied to poles covered with pitch while they're still alive and set on fire. To keep the lights going for his garden parties when it got dark. So think about it. If you were facing that at any moment, the real question is, okay, do I really want to be one of these believers or not? Do I really want to admit that I'm a follower or not? And so Mark, I think, among the purposes for the way Mark writes and the things that he records is to show that Jesus went through all this persecution for you. And he was opposed, and yet he continued to offer grace and love to the loveless and for those who had no love for him. If it's John Mark, as in the as tradition says, he probably in 30 when Jesus is crucified at the most is in his mid-teens. At the most, he's in his mid-teens. So you're talking from say he was born in 15, just picking a number, and he's 15 years old in 30. And then you're talking, 35 years later. So he's around 50.
Well, you see, this writing, I don't know if it was done when he was young or the notes that he made, he used those. But it seems to me he was young. And his interpretation.
Well, 50 is young.
Everything about this book is immediate to me.
Well, that's his thing.
You know, it's 1, 2, 3, 4.
Well, and he uses that a lot. You know, and immediately this happened. And immediately this happened. And suddenly this happened because, and that's
the impression I get of this man.
But see, that's the whole point of, okay, if you go out and you got these Romans that are looking to round up Christians, immediately you're gone. Suddenly you're gone. And so in the persecution of Jesus by the religious leaders and others, they didn't mince words and they didn't wait from what Mark records. You know, this happened quickly, and so Jesus had to react quickly. There are some scholars who think he wrote it in Galilee, but I think that's wrong because there are too many things that don't fit Galilee, and there are a lot of terms in the Greek text that are associated with Latin terms, and Latin, he wouldn't have done that if he was in Galilee. He was in Rome. That fits Rome better. So he's writing from Rome, mid to late 60s. Around the time Nero's persecuting Christians, around the time that both Peter and Paul die, and others are being killed, and crucifixions are taking place, and people are in the Colosseum being slaughtered simply because they refuse to deny being followers of Christus. And so, yes, that immediacy, but I'd say he's probably 40s to 50s around that time. But it does. And of course, if he's writing in that kind of setting, he can't just sit around and take his time. He's got to pin this down because it's liable to happen to him too. Although, he escapes from Rome, according to tradition, he escapes from Rome and he's actually, John Mark is actually the patron saint, of the Coptic Christian Church in Egypt. Now, he gives a very quick, in fact, a brief and sketchy outline of Mark would kind of be, this is the introduction, chapter 1, the first 13 verses, where he begins, the beginning of the euangelion, which is good news. We translate it gospel, but the Greek word euangelion simply means good news. The beginning of the good news or the gospel of Jesus Christ, and here he goes even further. He doesn't just say he's Messiah, he says the Son of God. As it is written in Isaiah the prophet, behold, I send my messenger before your face. Who shall prepare your way? So he starts out with this declaration. What I'm writing about is the good news that God, the Son of God is Jesus and he's Messiah. Then he says, now John the Baptist is out preaching, getting people ready for this. And Jesus comes and he's baptized and then he goes into the wilderness where he's tested. But we find Son of God as an important term. And Son of Man is the most important term in Mark to describe Jesus. But you've got this introduction that introduces us to, what is this document? It's good news about Jesus, who's the Son of God and Messiah. Jesus, the Christ, Christos, Messiah. Then how does he get to this point? Well, he doesn't have a birth narrative. He picks up immediately here with the ministry, the baptism and the ministry of Jesus. He's baptized by John, and when he's baptized by John, we'll talk more about this later, when he's baptized, the voice comes from heaven, and who hears it? According to Mark, it's Jesus. You're my beloved Son. With you I'm well pleased. Not the crowds, but Jesus.
And everybody hear
According to both Mark and Matthew, it is Jesus who hears it. Luke says that people hear something, and there's speculation, you know, the voice of God booms like thunder, that maybe there was this big clap of thunder, and Jesus is the one who really heard the voice, but the voice of God echoed through. They were not.
Where you literally heard the voice of God. I mean, now they're just saying that Jesus was the only one that heard it.
Well, it's Jesus, James, and John. So there are three of them that hear the voice, not just Jesus. So Jesus hears it, but on the Mount of Transfiguration, Peter, James, and John, the big triumvirate, the big three, they all hear it as well. Because he says, "This is my son, my beloved son, listen to him." Because Peter's wanting to build these booths up here and let's stay away from everybody else and have this mountaintop experience. When God speaks to Moses on the mountain, the people below hear a tremendous thunderstorm and watch a tremendous thunderstorm, and that was the theophany, the presence and the voice of God. But typically the voice of God is to small groups or to one individual.
Like even when he called Samuel.
Yes. Nobody but Samuel heard it. Eli gets insight, but nobody but Samuel heard it. And so you've got that. And then you've got the ministry from verse 14 of chapter 1 through chapter 8, verse 26, what is called the ministry of the secret Messiah in Galilee. From 8:27 through the end of chapter 10, we find mention of the Son of Man several times in there. And the Son of Man journeys to Jerusalem there to suffer and to die. Chapter 11 through chapter 13, we have how the secret Messiah comes to Jerusalem and there teaches, is glorified, and then is arrested. And then the Passion, chapters 14 through chapter 16, verse 8, which is where in the oldest manuscripts we have, the best Greek manuscripts we have, it ends in verse 8 with the women afraid and leaving and telling no one. Now, this whole thing of secret Messiah, in the synoptics, especially Mark, there are times, and Matthew and Luke follow, although Matthew softens it sometimes, but there are times where Jesus will heal somebody or he'll perform a miracle. He'll raise somebody from the dead, Jairus' daughter, and he says, "Now don't tell anybody." He heals a leper in Mark, and he says, "Now go show yourself to the priest, do the rituals that are supposed to, but don't tell anybody who did this."
Yes.
And also in Mark chapter 1, you've got the demoniac. Jesus goes to the synagogue, and it's SRO, standing room only, and you've got a demoniac who comes rushing in and cries out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? I know who you are. You're the Holy One of God," which was another designation for the Messiah. At that point, Jesus turns and tells him to be quiet and then casts him out. And the people are astonished that this is a new teaching. He casts out the demons. He controls the demons. Nobody says, "Well, wait a minute. This guy just called him the Holy One of God." You know, they miss that whole thing. I guess they're scared to death because this guy's bouncing around the room. Jairus' daughter. He raises Jairus' daughter from the dead. In the room are Jairus, his wife, Jesus, Peter, James, and John, and a dead girl. And he raises a girl from the dead. Everybody's outside. I mean, they've called a mortician, everything. Everybody's outside, upset. They know she's dead. They've checked her out. He raised her from the dead, and then the text says, and he charged them to tell no one what happened. Kind of tough. She was dead. Now she's alive. How do you not tell folks? What I think he meant there was, not to tell anybody how he accomplished it, because he uses that phrase, Talitha Kumi, little girl, get up.
Do they think that the demons cast out are literally 4 foot ogres, or is it a healing? In other words, the person is no longer insane or in pain or all the above?
Yes.
Yes, that's what I thought.
Some saw them as spiritual beings, as creatures Others, in fact, in some of the translations, the guy who would have fits and throw himself in the fire, and his dad said, you know, he hurts himself, he's going to kill himself. It's translated epileptic, because the word in some medical ancient Greek medical terminology means, you know, those fits of epilepsy.
What was that one about the demons being cast into the hogs that went over the vein or something like that?
Right, and that would have. I don't think the hogs had epilepsy, but that was seen as the casting out of spiritual
transferring
them to the pigs, because, you know, pigs, Schweinhund. But here this whole idea, Jesus will do this and he'll say, don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody. And when Peter says, I say you're the Christ, in that great confession in chapter 8, who do men say that I am? Well, who do you say that I am? Peter says, oh, you're the Messiah. Matthew adds, Son of the Living God. But in Mark, it's just, you're the Messiah. The very next phrase is, and he charged them to tell no one.
Was the don't tell anybody like, you're getting ahead of me, and I might be put upon and everything else earlier before my time. Or in other words, I need time, my 3 years, so to speak, instead of having 1 year or something like that.
If German theologian William Vreda noticed that, and he wrote a book in 1904, The Messianic Secret in the Gospels, and he said Mark basically made it all up. The format. The disciples didn't understand, the people didn't understand, and his way of explaining that they didn't understand Jesus as Messiah until after. Vreda said it's only after the resurrection that Jesus is seen as Christ. They couldn't understand beforehand, so Mark then makes up this whole secrecy thing to kind of get them off the hook. I think Vreda was off. Bultmann and some others agreed with him. A couple of English theologians, later Stephen Neal, who was Archbishop of Canterbury at one point, and Hugh Anderson, argued that Jesus had a very good reason, going with what you said, Ed. Jesus had a very good reason for them not to tell. I mean, as I put it oftentimes, he didn't want to literally play Caesar's Palace as a wonder worker. And he didn't want to be seen as just another wonder worker, because that demeans, A, can demean what he's doing, but B, if the zealots, if the disciples start saying, yeah, and the zealots get behind it, then Jesus might be slaughtered by the Romans or an errant arrow or spear before he can complete his mission. And there were very real reasons, because the Romans, you start saying somebody's Messiah, they're the king, and the Romans are going to say, hold on, time out, we're going to wipe all of you out. So they said it was a very good reason, because, I mean, in religious circles, the term Messiah is a very pregnant term. That is, it gives birth to all kinds of ideas. And so they said there was a very good reason for that. However, if you look at Mark and you read the gospel, almost every time that it happens, it's almost formulaic. I think that what probably happens is, I think it was a very real reason for him to keep it down early so that it didn't come undone or that it didn't get belittled. But I think as Mark recorded it, Mark thought it through, and Mark creates the formula by which the historical kernel is actually the vehicle by which the historical kernel is given. So yes, I think Vreda was wrong saying Mark simply made it up, but I think, you know, God allowed Mark to pick words and phrases that he guarded the truth, but allowed him to write so that people who were being persecuted could understand it. And so he uses this kind of formula, but that it actually was to keep it Jesus from being taken out too soon, or his ministry not to occur as it should. Mark understood that they cried out.
And then it says, you are of God. That's what the evil spirit said. You are of God.
Yeah.
And then he says, but he gave them strict orders not to tell who he was. Is he speaking to the evil spirits?
Yes, he's speaking to the evil spirits at that point.
That's strange.
Well, it is. But, you know, he and from there on out, Anytime, if you'll look at the Gospel of Mark, that's the only time that anybody with an evil spirit, that the evil spirit speak up. Anytime anybody else has an evil spirit or fits or whatever, they're forbidden to speak before. This is the only time that they speak first. And then Jesus tells them to shut up every other time. They're silenced so that they don't keep telling this kind of thing. So, you know, I think there's kind of a combination here. And in Mark, in expressing his sense of Christology, Jesus is not just Messiah. He's Son of God, and he's Son of Man. Now, in the Old Testament, most of the time, Son of Man simply means person. Right. And it's talking about a person. It's not talking about Messiah or Son of God. But in the intertestamental period, that period between the end of the writing of the Old Testament and the New Testament era, in that period there, a lot of the theology that develops and the writings that develop, the Son of Man is a heavenly figure. And so you have Messiah that's going to set up the earthly kingdom of God, and then the Son of Man brings about the heavenly kingdom of God. In fact, in a couple of the apocryphal writings, or the things in the pseudepigrapha, you almost get them together as one person, and they separate out again. It's only in Jesus that the gospel writers then come back and say, wait a minute, he's not just Messiah, he's also Son of Man. He's the God-man, bringing about all kingdom, not just part of it, etc. In fact, he uses a variety of titles for Jesus, including Son of God, Son of David, Christos, or the Christ, Lord, Son of Mary, Teacher, and Son of Man. He uses Son of Man 14 different times. Son of God 5 times, Son of David 3, Christ 7 times, Lord 4 times, Son of Mary once, and Teacher 10 times. So Son of Man is the most important. Son of God is second most important to him. But as Son of Man, Jesus has the power to forgive sins, because this heavenly Son of Man could forgive sins in the heavenly kingdom of God. So he has the power to forgive sins. He is superior to the law and therefore defines the law. And he is the judge, but he's also the Lamb who suffers and dies for sins. So all of those things are part of this whole idea of the Son of Man, this heavenly kingship of God. As I said before, Mark's gospel is filled with conflict as well. Conflict and opposition. Conflict and opposition. From early on, I mean, he's baptized, and the text says, and the Spirit drove him into the wilderness. By the way, Matthew didn't like the idea. He changes the word. And the Spirit led him into the wilderness. Matthew didn't like the idea of Jesus being driven somewhere or pushed somewhere. Same sentence. Drove, led. Where he is tempted. Now, we say tempted, and the word can be translated tempted, but what's really interesting is that particular Greek word in that paraizein means to test or to put to the test. And so part of his conflict early on in his life is he goes into the wilderness where he is separated out and put to the test to prove that that he is indeed ready to do this. Yes, Ariel.
Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, when his family heard about it, they said, "What? He is out of his mind."
Yeah. Yes.
Think about your family saying, "You're out of your mind."
His mom and his brothers were outside, and they said, "We came to get him because he's." Yeah. They were afraid. They were afraid he was going off the deep end. Somebody was going to do something to hurt him.
I mean, that is down to earth, which is
Jesus.
Dead.
They're afraid Jesus is going to be hurt
for
all of this.
So intense,
yes. Right.
Take charge of Jesus, yes, as if he needed to be taken care of.
Well, because even then, they didn't understand the import of who
he
was.
Out of his mind. Yeah. I was just going to say, he had to be tempted to show that he was God, because man yields to temptation. Adam and Eve.
Well,
how long did it take them to fall into temptation, and then they said,
And he also had to be tempted so that he could show us how we humans are to react to temptation. In fact, the New Testament later says, tempted in every way like we, yet without sin. And these, the temptations, which Mark just says he was tempted, he got over it or got through it, and the angels ministered to him. It's Matthew and Luke that give us the temptations out there. But the whole thing about whether to die or not is a temptation. And in facing death, he chose to follow God. But it's this opposition. He was being put to the test. The word means to be put to the test, to try, as being tried and true, and to be tempted as well. The first half, he is characterized by oppositions of demons and religious leaders. And I'm going to finish here in a second. Which he meets with exorcisms. He exorcises the demons. And yes, over the years on tests, when I've asked questions and people write about things, I have gotten, people don't know how to spell. And then I have these images of Jesus giving them calisthenics because they say he exorcises demons. But he meets the religious leaders with debate. Debate, debate, debate. And they can't stand his debate. They can't stand his debate. But, you know, he's opposed by them because he dares to say he can forgive sins in the name of God. And they say, only God can forgive sins. Well, actually, Jesus says you and I have the power to forgive sins or not. But that's considered blasphemy according to Jewish tradition. He associates with the wrong kind of folks. Tax collectors and other sinners. That kind of puts the tax collectors in an interesting light, the way Mark looks at it. He doesn't do all the fasts, and he breaks the law of the Sabbath. And even lets his disciples do that, going through the grain field and picking it up to do all this kind of stuff and eat on the Sabbath. Y'all are working. That's true. That's what I've been trying to say about this show on TV, 1984. Well, actually, they call it Big Brother, but I call it 1984. I don't watch it, but I think what these reality shows like that, what they teach people is it's okay to lie, cheat, and steal to get what you want.
No way.
I mean, if you really think about it, all these people on Big Brother and Survivor and all this are trying to win this money, and they lie, cheat, and steal to do it, and it's just teaching everybody you can lie, cheat, and steal to get what you want.
Right.
In the second half of the gospel, he is opposed by his friends and even his disciples. When Jesus says, you're the Christ, and says, Jesus, don't tell anybody. And then he starts teaching them how the Son of Man must suffer and die. And Peter says, wait a minute, you can't do that. You can't do that. We're not going to let you go. And that's where Jesus says, wait a minute, get behind me. You're acting just like the devil, trying to keep me from getting to where I need to be. Just a short time before. And he's also with this testing. Mark is trying to help people understand. Jesus sets the example for anybody that will take up the cross and follow him. And the disciples will be put to the test as well. One last quote and we'll be done. My friend and colleague, former colleague Alan Culpepper, who is an internationally known scholar in New Testament and who was the dean for the Mercer School of Theology, wrote, and I quote, "His is a gospel for the persecuted community and is first and foremost a gospel of hope. God's eschatological sovereignty, that is, God as a sovereign all the way to the end, has torn the heavens, crossed the boundaries, and been proclaimed by God's own Son. The long-expected Messiah had come. Even the Roman Emperor, who was worshipped as divine, a Savior, and the Son of God, pales by comparison to Jesus. Jesus alone is truly the Son of God, and those who follow Him will be vindicated and gathered with the elect when the Son of Man comes in the glory of His Father with the holy angels." End of quote. Yeah, but those elect are the ones who elect to accept. And Alan's about as Baptist and about as opposite to predestination as you're going to find. But next time what we will do is we'll start in chapter 1 and begin looking more closely at the major stories of that we find in the major story that we find starting with his declaration, the ministry of John the Baptizer, and the baptism of Jesus. Thank y'all. God bless you. Go in peace. And be careful.
Next time.